Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Coming up on the show today, we're going to talk about the relaxation of COVID-19 restrictions for much of the Sacramento region and how school districts are preparing for a possible return to at least some in-person learning. But first up this morning, the glass fire in Napa and Sonoma counties started just 3 days ago, but it has burned nearly 57,000 acres at last check, according to CAL FIRE. It has just 5% containment, and a red flag warning has been issued for the area, which could complicate firefighting efforts and puts many more people in the fire's potential path. Photos on our website, capradio.org, show some of the hundreds of structures that have either been damaged or destroyed. Cap Radio's Scott Rodd was in Napa covering the fires, and he spoke with residents and vineyard owners about the damage. And he's with us in studio today to give us an update on what he saw and reported on, as well as talk about how this will affect the Napa wine industry in the long term. And Scott, as always, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks for having me.
So this fire grew incredibly fast. What are some of the conditions that led to where we are today?
Well, the immediate conditions are heat, dry conditions, you know, dried out forest land, and then also pretty high wind conditions in that initial first couple of days that really is what caused the fire to take off. But also notable is that this area that's burning right now hasn't had a fire in recorded California history in about 70 or so decades of, you know, detailed history about fires. And so, you know, there was the Tubbs Fire, there were some other fires in this area. This is a chunk of forest land that hadn't seen that. So those are sort of some of the immediate and bigger conditions that led up to what caused this fire to spread so quickly. In the last couple of days, it hasn't spread quite as quick, but as you mentioned, the conditions coming up today and tomorrow are not looking good.
No. And we will have a meteorologist on a little bit later to help us understand just how serious that is. The fire stretches over two counties, threatening and destroying homes in the population center of Santa Rosa in Sonoma County, but also vineyards and wineries in Napa County, where you visited. What were some of the things that you saw in the Napa Valley that stood out to you as soon as you got there?
So when I got there, this was on Tuesday. It was when the fire had calmed down a little bit, and you know, you saw destruction, you saw still sort of spot fires burning here and there. What was interesting was there wasn't at that point sort of this big active fire line. What was happening was, you know, there was a lot of smoldering, there was a lot of sort of fire that was creeping around, but nothing that was this big, huge wall of fire sort of. It was almost like, in my shoes at least, chasing this kind of phantom fire line. Still certainly destruction happening, still an active fire, certainly. But the other thing that stood out to me is, you know, fire has this weird kind of unpredictable prejudice where, you know, one property may be completely torched, the structure burned down, you know, a vineyard may, you know, have been completely just ablaze and turned to soot. But right next to it, there may be a property that looked more or less untouched. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think is very hard for people to wrap their heads around, is this kind of often irrational, as I said, prejudice of fire, that some properties can really get hit hard, but right next door, there may be some that are just fine.
Yeah, if you look at the CAL FIRE outline, the map that they've made for this fire, it's really, you know, jagged and jumps around, and there's holes and openings, more so than most fires that I've seen in the past. And my sister has a home in the North Bay that the exact thing that you were talking about, this goes back several years to a fire that was burning in Lake County, and the entire neighborhood was just destroyed, and her one home was just standing. Untouched. Exactly. I've seen it firsthand.
It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this is happening in wine country. Can you describe some of the damage that wineries and vineyards that you saw? Because when I think of the valley floor and even some of the surrounding hillsides, they're lush and green. So I don't think of them as vulnerable to this, but as we've seen with some of the photos and stuff, they very much are.
Yeah, they certainly are. And on that point of, you know, some structures being completely burned and destroyed and others being untouched, I stopped by Castello di Amorosa. It's a fairly well-known winery in that area, partly because it has this iconic castle that was sort of designed after, you know, a medieval castle. And fortunately, the castle was more or less untouched by this fire. But, you know, maybe 30 yards beside it, there was this similar-looking stone farmhouse that had been completely burned from the inside out. And I spoke to the president of the winery, George Salzner, and he summed it up this way.
I have to say, this is probably the most challenging vintage that every winemaker is confronted with in the last 30 years. And, you know, we had mold, we have, yes, we had fire, we had smoke, but this year is by far the hardest vintage that I can remember.
So there wasn't any crop damage, direct crop damage from the fire at this winery, but this farmhouse held millions of dollars worth of wine bottles, wine stock going back years, equipment for bottling and fermenting. So that was a pretty heartbreaking hit for this winery. As I drove around elsewhere, as you mentioned, there were places in the, you know, the valley floor that was seeing some damage, certainly. But a lot of what I saw was once you got into the more hilly areas, you know, that's where the fire kind of took off and you could see just spread across it. And I distinctly remember in my mind one of the most sort of memorable, that's maybe a strange word for it, but the things that sticks in my mind from being there, I drove through some of the hills between Napa and Sonoma, and that whole area was really charred pretty bad. And it made me think of how there are different what are called terroirs in winemaking or in wine grape growing that, you know, offer essentially different elevations, different type of terrain that, you know, are valuable for grape growing. And there were vineyards throughout these hills and these wooded areas. And while that may have been a valuable asset for growing certain types of grapes and having certain results, you know, those hillsides also result in pretty rough and vulnerable fire areas. So you could see the flames really probably just climbed right up those hills and gobbled up some of those vineyards, unfortunately.
And of course, the potential, as we mentioned, with the winds picking up, could just spread that even further. I grew up in the region, Scott. I have family throughout Sonoma and Napa counties. I've never seen anything like what we've seen over the last, 4 years, I guess, of pretty severe fires. The difference this year is that we're seeing the fires earlier in August and September, not late October. What's the impact there?
The biggest impact is these fires are hitting in the heart of harvest season. You know, so previous years there were tragic, destructive fires. The one that stands out most is the Tubbs Fire in 2017. 22 people were killed tragically. But the wine industry certainly had its challenges with that, but many of the grapes were off the vine. This year we were seeing fires crop up in August, in September. And that created not only, you know, some damage directly from the fires, a lot of vineyards and wineries were actually spared from those early fires from direct damage, but there was widespread smoky conditions. And what that does is potentially contaminate the grapes that are on the vine. And, you know, this isn't the smokiness that you might want or think of in a glass of wine. Right. That often comes from the, you know, fermenting and barreling and aging process. This is what I was told by winemakers is kind of like an ashtray taste. It's not an ideal smokiness. So, yeah, the big impact here this year is you're seeing fires creep into harvest season. And so that's really created a mess, honestly, throughout sort of, you know, much of the industry, you know, this year. It's been a really tough one.
And this extends beyond Napa and Sonoma's wine growing region. We have, you know, a lot of grapes down in Lodi and here in the Central Valley. And that smoke, as we witnessed here in Sacramento, hung around thick for weeks. And so I know that they are studying this at UC Davis. We had a researcher on to talk about that, and she described it very similar to you, that it's not that smoky taste that we think of. It's more of an ashy back of your throat, not what you want.
I believe that was Anita Oberholster, and I spoke to her too, actually, and she said the same thing. And you know, she described that, like, right now, you know, this year is going to be just very, very challenging. Honestly, from, you know, every sort of stage of the industry, you know, growers right now are renegotiating contracts on the fly because they have these grapes that were out on the vine. They're harvesting them when they think is not only ideal for the crop, but also taking into consideration potential smoke damage. And, you know, they're trying to get these grapes tested at labs that are completely backed up.
Right.
You know, in previous years, you know, in an average sort of non sort of fire prone or fire overwhelmed year, testing might take a few days, maybe up to a week. Right now, you're talking about turnaround times a month, 5 weeks, 6 weeks out. And these growers have to make decisions about harvesting and, you know, trying to sell these grapes within days or weeks. So that's a huge challenge there. Testing, as I said, is backed up. You know, there's one main laboratory. A couple others have cropped up here and there, but there's one main laboratory that handles a lot of these grapes, and they're you know, cranking. They're doing the best they can, but there is a lot of backup. And then with winemakers, they have to make, they're trying to navigate, do I purchase these grapes that may have been tainted? That you know, I'm running a risk here of making wines that, you know, may ultimately damage my reputation or the reputation of our label. And so much of the wine industry is about reputation, putting out a good product continually, consistently. And part of this calculation of this, you know, this gamble is that smokiness can actually, that it can actually come up years later after the bottling process. So it may seem like it's gone when you first bottle it. I spoke to one winemaker who said 10 years after bottling a wine, that smokiness came back. So there is this big gamble there. Some winemakers are requiring that the grapes be tested before they purchase them. Some are doing what's called micro-fermentation, where they're kind of skipping or trying to maybe get around the log-jammed testing process by making mini batches of crushed fermented grapes and then seeing if there's a smokiness that comes off, relying on the old smell test, basically.
Right.
And that also allows these winemakers to maintain a kind of intimate relationship that they often have with vineyards, where they can invite them in and say, look, you know, you can smell with your own nose that this is unusable. These grapes are unusable for winemaking. And, you know, then move from there as to how they can try to ensure that the vineyard gets crop insurance coverage, whatever it may be. And retailers right now are also expressing concern. You know, the last thing you'd want is for a certain vintage to have kind of a scarlet letter and to be known as that year with all the smoke.
So true. I mean, Scott, the wine industry is built here in Northern California on quality for sure, but also on perception. Some wines sell based on what you expect them to be and what they're sold as. And I can see where the retailers might be a little concerned that people will be like, I don't want to buy any wines from here right now.
Exactly. And I guess to make clear, like, there are going to be wines from 2020 from this region, you know, and by all accounts, you know, from the folks I talked to, like, there are going to be some great wines that come out of this. Like, it's going to be, you know, still, you know, a good, the things that are going to be produced are still going to be good. And it's not like the region is totally decimated. Let's not overstate the problem. But there is this concern about perception and this fear that, you know, retailers won't want to take that gamble. A lot of this is just coming down to like a number of sort of calculated gambles.
Right.
And just to go back, that there is for growers that do not purchase grapes from vineyards that grow the grapes themselves, you know, they're in a somewhat different position. Their gamble is they may get their crops tested. They are also in a position where it may make more sense for them to just go ahead and make the wine. They already have the grapes and take the gamble of saying, we're going to bottle this and, you know, hope for the best. But they have a little more control over that process.
Yeah. So we don't have a lot of time left, Scott, but I do want to get to moving forward. We need to underscore, this is not a usual year. Our producer, Kyle McKinnon, is in his first year at Cap Radio. When I think about everything that's going on right now, I keep wanting to tell him, like, this is not what it's normally like. I mean, 5 of the 6 largest fires in California history have all burned within the last 2 months, and some are still burning. So with that in mind, looking at the bigger picture, this isn't going away soon. So how's the industry handling this?
You know, this isn't a normal year, but there are certain things that are happening right now that are likely going to become the new normal. And, you know, I spoke to Lee Hanna. He's a senior scientist at Conservation International. And this is the kind of warning that he issued for the industry.
Vineyards are going to be dealing with these changes for decades to come. Some of the changes may be very, very difficult to cope with if we don't get something done about climate change. So that's the first step. But then beyond that, then vineyards need to be thinking about changing varietals because temperatures are going to warm, and regions are going to have to think about changing their marketing, because if they're currently marketing Pinot as the signature varietal of their region, that may not be the case in the future. So vineyards need to be looking decades ahead to figure out what their growing conditions are going to be and what their marketing should be.
Which is a pretty scary warning for the industry. Mm-hmm. And winemakers, growers are thinking about this. I asked vineyard owners, I asked winemakers, is this scaring you off? Are you thinking about potentially moving elsewhere where there may not be these concerns? And I got to tell you, the folks in Napa and Sonoma have this pride about this region, about in this connection. And everyone I spoke to said, no, we're committed to this. This region is here to stay. We're going to roll with the punches.
Capradio's Scott Rodd, you're such an asset to the newsroom. Thank you so much for coming in this morning to share this reporting with us. He's our state government reporter and now our wine reporter. Scott, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we'll hear from the top meteorologist at the National Weather Service in Sacramento about upcoming extreme fire weather that will likely complicate current firefighting efforts. Also, the state of California has relaxed some COVID-19 restrictions for Sacramento and some surrounding counties. We'll dive into that. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our focus this first portion of the show is the wildfires that are burning and the weather that's contributing to that, with five of the six largest wildfires in California's recorded history burning over the past 2 months. It may seem like a relief to enter October today, but the truth is October, November, and even December historically have seen some of the state's most destructive wildfires in recent years, including Butte County's Camp Wildfire. That was a November fire. The Tubbs Fire in Sonoma County was October, and the Thomas Fire in Ventura and Santa Barbara counties hit in December. One big reason for this is gusty, dry winds that often develop in the fall before the rainy season has a chance to increase moisture levels in the state's grasses, shrubs, and trees. Sometimes you just collectively hear that as vegetation. Michelle Mead is the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service office in Sacramento, and she returns to Insight to help us understand where we stand forecast-wise with two destructive and deadly fires currently burning in Northern California and what could still lie ahead. Great to have you here, Michelle.
Thanks.
Yeah, nice to have you. Nice to have you back. And this is one of those pivotal points in California's weather year, is it not?
It is. The fall is when we transition to, we transition to these offshore wind events. Folks are very, very familiar with the Santa Ana. That is basically what that is a fancy name for the downslope or offshore wind events, and it impacts the Santa Ana range down in SoCal. But we do get the same phenomena up here.
Right. And when that wind downslopes, as you called it, when it comes down a mountain, It has the potential to really heat up. What causes that? Why is there that huge temperature rise? In fact, yesterday or the day before at Cal Poly in San Luis Obispo, some winds that I think they called the Santa Lucia winds there came down off of the range, and the temperature in San Luis Obispo jumped by 40 degrees in just a matter of like an hour or two. What causes
Correct.
That? What causes
it's
that?
Called compressional warmth.
Uh-huh.
So as the
you know
air
what,
parcel is coming down the mountain.
Yeah, Michelle, I'm sorry. We're having a delay and an audio issue with you. So our producer Kyle's going to give you a phone call really fast here. And so we'll hear from you in just a moment. That's Michelle Mead. She's the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service in Sacramento, giving us some sense as to what we can expect weather-wise as we enter October. We know that the dry winds pick up this time of year, even though we've already experienced 2 months of extreme fire weather. It potentially could get worse as we continue to dry out and get these winds. Michelle, when we hear the term extreme fire weather, what are we talking about?
So basically, we're talking about very high winds, unseasonably strong winds, humidity levels that are in the single digits and the teens, and extremely dry fuels. So, of course, the fuels are always dry this time of year, but it's the winds and the humidity that we concentrate on as meteorologists.
And then we hear that term red flag warning, which has been issued for the area around the Glass Fire. Last year, the National Weather Service even created a new category called an extreme red flag warning. I guess there was a need for that.
Correct, because fire weather is something that most Californians are used to dealing with or hearing the term. But when we see these very anomalous or things that only happen like once every 10 years, as far as winds and humidity, we needed to come up with a way to basically raise awareness to people. So that's where the extreme wording came from. And we try to, heighten the messaging and let folks know that, this is one of those scenarios that if a spark does create a fire, it could very quickly get out of control, which is the definition of a red flag warning. But when you've got conditions that, we don't see but once every 10 years, which unfortunately we've been seeing a lot lately in the last several years, it's just wanting folks to be especially careful and precaution.
Yeah. How unusual has 2020 been weather-wise?
It has definitely been a hot summer, which we all know. It started early. We had an on-again, off-again rain over the 2019-2020 winter that ended early, unfortunately. And then the heat turned on really quickly. So what that means is for the what they call fine fuels, or all those grasses that typically stay green until, say, June or early July, were turning brown in May because we were already in the 90s. And here we are October 1st, and we're talking about triple-digit heat. So not only are we seeing, record-breaking temperatures, but it's lasting a lot longer when we're seeing upper 90s in May and then triple digits in the first week of October, which I heard you guys talking earlier about, being new here. I've been here for 7 years, and I got here in the middle of the drought. And, my son at the time, I have twin boys, and when it did start raining in 2017, they're like, well, it doesn't rain here, because they never experienced it. So,
right.
And everyone's like, well, this is what it used to be like. So there's definitely a lot going on with the temperatures and the weather patterns, especially when it comes to fire weather, because folks used to ask me all the time, or even when I started in the weather service, it was kind of like when October comes around, when you've hit the equinox, fire season is technically over because you lose the daylight hours and everything else, but that is not the case anymore. Fire season is year round in California, unfortunately.
How long might this red flag situation last for the current fires that are burning?
So the current fires, we had two new ones over the weekend, as you know, one up in Shasta and the other one, the Glass Fire in the Napa area. And those were as a result of those extremely high winds. And because we are so hot right now, basically what happens is when you get this bubble of hot air, is the best way to put it, that develops over the Central Valley, you get those winds that are coming off the coastal range. And with, like you were discussing earlier, you get the compressional heating. So as they're coming down the mountain, they're heating up very quickly. And unfortunately, they're also drying things out. So the ridge, the bubble of hot air, we're going to see for at least another day, meaning into Friday. And then hopefully the bubble will burst a little bit. This is the best way of putting it. And we'll start to see a return to that onshore flow, which is what we like to see this time of year, because that definitely brings in the cooler air and, most importantly, the more moisture into the air.
Yeah.
Because when you're blowing off, it's dry. When it's blowing on, it's moist.
Michelle, I cannot end this conversation with you without asking if there's any chance of rain in the coming weeks.
Well, funny you should say that. We've actually been watching the long-range models, and it does look like they are hinting at a quote-unquote pattern change, which means our bubble will officially burst, and we'll get a weather system somewhere along the Pacific coast into Northern California, and that's where I always put the caveat, because we don't know exactly where it's going to hit, but it does look like after the 10th of October, we may see a transition. So definitely keep an eye on the forecast. We want, you know, a lot. We would like at least, you know, half an inch of rain, but we want it to come over a slow period of time, because the other issue we're going to be dealing with this winter, of course, is too much too fast. And I heard you reference the Thomas Fire, which was a late season fire. And then we had a extreme rain event, which meant we got a lot of rain in a short amount of time. And it resulted in the Montecito. So we want to make sure that, you know, I wish we could control it, but we can't. But that's definitely something we watch, is to make sure that when those systems do come in, we watch for any of those convective or high intense short duration rainfalls.
Yeah.
So, but definitely stay alert. Just because it's raining doesn't mean the threat is over.
Right. Michelle Mead.
If you're near a burn scar.
Michelle is the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service office in Sacramento. We love having you as a friend of the show, because you give us that dose of weather reality that we need every so often. thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
And we should note, because of today's expected heat coupled with some other complications, including the fires, California's Independent System Operator, or CAISO, the organization that manages the state's power supply, has issued a flex alert for today, asking you to reduce your energy usage this afternoon and this evening. It's all in an attempt to avoid those rolling blackouts. Another big story this week has to do with developments regarding a sustained drop in Northern California's COVID-19 cases. The state announced on Tuesday that Sacramento, Yolo, San Joaquin, and Butte counties all are now in the less restrictive red tier for COVID-19 control. This means restaurants in several of the Sacramento area's largest cities can now open for limited indoor dining. We're not talking about full dining rooms. I think it's 25% capacity. For minority-owned businesses outside of Sacramento's main business core, the change could mean some much-needed relief for both owners and customers. Cap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan is here to share some of her reporting on this development. And by here, I mean via Zoom from her home. Nice to see you, Sarah.
Nice to be here again, Randall.
So the restaurant owners, how are they feeling about this return to 25% capacity indoors? Because, Sarah, I remember when the lockdowns first happened and then they got stretched out and stretched out, a lot of owners were like, I'm not going to be able to reopen at 25% capacity. But maybe that's changed a bit over the months.
Yeah, you know, unfortunately, I would say overall, what we're seeing across a number of business districts that I spoke with, most are feeling very positive about this reopening, that might be a fair way to say it, especially for restaurants that are located in underserved neighborhoods like South and North Sacramento, along corridors that have not received a whole lot of federal or local loans for any number of reasons, and in areas where outdoor dining is not possible just because of location or the type of street that they're located on. I think a lot of these restaurants are seeing this reopening to 25% capacity as a relief. Here's Corey DeRue of the Florin Road Partnership.
We are so thrilled that indoor dining is finally a possibility for the businesses on Florin Road. You know, while the alfresco dining was a good option for midtown and downtown type locations, the traffic, the amount of accidents, and the speeding on Florin Road made that just nearly impossible for the restaurants in South Sacramento.
I've thought about that heading down Stockton Boulevard. There's so many great restaurants along that stretch. And during the pandemic, I've thought it's just such a shame that there's not this outdoor corridor where they can set up tents and, you know, do the same thing that we've been seeing in midtown and downtown. So how have restaurants who have not been able to participate in outdoor dining been faring? How have they stayed afloat?
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I think this kind of ties into your earlier question. It's a mixed bag for sure. So some restaurants basically are embracing the ability to reopen in whatever small capacity they can. You had mentioned that earlier. Yeah, a lot of restaurants did feel 25% of their full indoor dining capacity wasn't necessarily worth it. They didn't want that. And now I think, you know, almost 7 months into this pandemic at this point, a lot of those restaurants who may have earlier said, no, we don't want to do that, it's not worth it, are changing their tone just because they're feeling squeezed. You know, if you had been a business in along one of these busier corridors like Stockton Boulevard, you would have basically just been surviving off of takeout, or maybe you weren't doing anything at all just because of your location and what you were able to do financially. So, you know, in the positive side, we have Paula Yang. She's the owner of King Palace, which is a well-known dim sum restaurant. It's a banquet style hall, very popular with weddings and large parties. And obviously those are not returning anytime soon. But she says she hasn't paid rent in months and she's got an understanding landlord. So she obviously still has the place. But she is absolutely looking forward to offering limited indoor dining. Here she is.
It's tiring. You know, it's tiring. It's a very heavy weight in the heart. It's like that, you know, see what's going to happen. But anyway, this is my last Wednesday closing the restaurant. So hopefully everything be back another 10% next, you know, this 20% this month, you know.
Oh, a heavy weight in the heart. That breaks my heart hearing her say that.
Yeah, totally. You know, I think right now what she's really looking forward to, she mentioned, are the November and December holidays. Those are traditionally really big, big holidays for her restaurant, where a lot of families and parties would traditionally have booked with her. So she's hoping that come Thanksgiving, come Christmas time, the state will have relaxed those restrictions enough to allow for maybe 50% dining, or even 60 or 80% to allow her to recoup a lot of the cancellations that have happened to her earlier in the year. You know, she mentioned her third biggest holiday is Mother's Day, and that was, of course, smack in the middle of the pandemic, and she missed that entirely. So yeah, you know, I think she's trying to keep the hope, but I also know that, of course, experts are worried about us seeing another surge in the winter months, so we'll have to see. You know, I think she said basically if she misses out on revenue from these two big holidays, it's going to certainly mean something big for her business.
Sarah, you also visited a place on Del Paso Boulevard. I say up on Del Paso Boulevard because of where physically I'm located right now, but North Sac.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, we've got another business owner perspective, Khalid Farhood. He owns a Sammy's restaurant on Del Paso Boulevard in North Sacramento. He's owned this diner style restaurant since 1996. And he says to him, 25% is still not worth reopening. Here he is.
We have some people come breakfast, some people breakfast and lunch, some people breakfast, lunch and dinner. It's like people meet. It's a meeting place. You know, I got sick. I got diabetes from staying home because I'm used to work 7 days a week.
So he's one of those people who has their tune hasn't changed. It's like it's not worth it to be open at just 25% capacity.
Yeah. So for him, he's in a fortunate position. He owns the building that his restaurant is in. And so he does not necessarily feel that crunch to have to pay rent. And so his restaurant has been entirely closed. They have not been doing takeout. They've not been doing outdoor dining. And so they've just been closed since March, basically. And that's been really sad for him since, as he mentioned, you know, he loved this place. He's owned it for, you know, over 20 years at this point. But I think he said, like, just cost analysis wise, like, given that 25% for his business will mean essentially allowing seating for six people, he doesn't have a very big restaurant, just like getting his staff up and running for basically six people is just not worth it.
Right.
Unfortunately.
Sarah, are any worried that there could be a spike in cases and another round of closures like earlier in the pandemic we saw heading into the summer?
Definitely. Yeah. But a number of business associations have said that at this point, restaurants that have been able to survive and stay open this long and this far, they're kind of expecting this kind of cycle of openings and closings and spikes and lulls. They're basically accepting that risk. And I guess from a business perspective, for a lot of them, it's a lot more risky to just say they're going to wait it out until the pandemic is totally over rather than basically trying to open at whatever capacity they can, whenever they can.
Yeah. I'll feel like the pandemic is over when I can go to Chinese buffet on Stockton Boulevard on Christmas Day. That's my tradition. So Gap Radio's Sarah Mises-Tan, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us this morning. Always such a great job.
Oh, thanks so much, Randall. It's great to be here.
Still ahead, we'll speak with the head of the Natomas Unified School District, which is planning to transition to some level of in-person teaching. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Schools in Sacramento County are preparing for a possible return to campus for some level of in-person teaching. According to the county, SAC schools could reopen with in-person classes, but that's only if the county meets criteria for the red tier for 2 weeks. Chris Evans is the superintendent of the Natomas Unified School District. Natomas is planning to roll out some degree of in-person teaching, and Chris Evans joins us now. Thank you for being here.
Oh, you're welcome. Good morning, Randall.
Yeah, so it's great to have you back. We've checked in with you from time to time as things have progressed, I guess. So what does the lowering of Sacramento County from the purple tier to the red tier mean for public schools and, of course, Natomas Unified as well?
Sure, like nothing immediately, but in terms of students returning, but it does signal that the possibility of a return to staff and parents. And so, you know, each district's taking a different approach. Each district has its local context. For us, we actually just came to an agreement yesterday with our teachers association to bring in what we're calling supplemental in-person small group cohorts, which means, you know, we've been pretty smart about phasing this approach in. We brought athletes back in June. We brought daycares and day camps onto campus without our own staff, with a second party partner in August. So we've had about 700 kids on our campuses for a few months, and now we're going to add more. And so after distance learning is done, there's going to be in-person small group opportunities for students to return to schools and work with their teacher, in particular for those whose parents or students and or staff are saying distance learning really isn't the best way for kids to learn.
When the kids come in, I'll say when, because we'll keep our fingers crossed that, you know, this 2 week period will be successful. When the kids are allowed to come back for this hybrid level of learning, does that mean that the teachers have to have two separate lesson plans, the lesson plan for the kids that are there that day and the lesson plan for the kids that are at home?
It could. It depends on what each district negotiates with their association. I mean, there's ways to do it. So it's the same lesson planning. It's the potential to be two lesson plans. And we just did a pretty large survey of our staff, students and parents, and our staff expressed a worry and a concern, a nice chunk of them, that kids aren't always doing the independent, what they call asynchronous work. Students and parents felt a little different. They felt like students were always or sometimes doing it, but staff thought that was lower. So that's something I think each district has to understand. To what extent are your kids doing the independent work? And if they're not, then that's not a great thing to give them two or three days a week of, hey, you're on your own, kiddo, independently.
Right.
So I think each district is being smart. They're engaging their stakeholders. They're engaging the community. And there'll probably be multiple approaches to this in Sacramento County.
Superintendent, I believe I've asked you about this in the past, but I'm wanted a little bit of an update as well. And that is, you have charter schools in your district.
We do.
How do they fold into the changes over the next few weeks?
Yeah, so they have to follow the same rules that we do, and we have a good relationship with them. And we just met with them. It was either earlier this week or Friday. All these Zooms and phone calls,
right?
Run together, and they each have their own decisions. One's already announced that they're not coming back until January, and they can stay in distance learning, and has some sound academic reasons for that. The other two are trying to take all of this into consideration. So they all have their own governing boards. So they won't necessarily, they have different calendars and schedules. So they won't do things lockstep with us. That's not an expectation, but it's what's really nice is we're having conversations every few weeks and getting a sense for what each group's doing.
Are there any infrastructure upgrades or changes to the campus or campuses that the district has been working on? I'm thinking about improved air circulation, desk distancing, those sorts of things.
Yeah. So yes, very much so. And we're actually pretty far ahead, which is why we're able to open our small group cohorts. We opened one this week with not our own teachers, but basically consultants, if you will, helping out until we had this deal done yesterday. We've upgraded the air filters to the state and federal recommendation. It's more money and it will have more strain on the AC units, but it's better for staff and kids. We've gone an extra mile and we purchased a portable HEPA filter unit that we're going to put in every classroom and in workspaces for our classified employees. So there's an extra layer of filtering some of that through. And then in terms of desks and movement around that, we've gone ahead and hired a second party independent architect to come in and actually use little drafting, if you will, and design where desks can safely be structured in each classroom and which ones would need like plastic shields or barriers and where desks can go. You know, gosh, in June, we were thinking, oh, we'll let the teacher figure it out as long as they can do a tape measure. And now that we've, been in this for 7 months, we're a little wiser. So we go outside and we get expert help that each teacher will see, this is what your room should look like to meet the size requirements when we do our transition or return, which, you know, we'll see how this in small cohort goes. If that goes well and the cases don't spike, then, you know, that's when we really start talking about the transitional return.
You mentioned some things that sound expensive to me, expert help. HEPA filters, all of that does run up a cost. There was a period during the debate the other night that I could make out what was being said on stage, and the cost to bring children back to school was brought up. And I'm wondering, where does that come from? How is Natomas Unified, for example, paying for all of that?
So we got a really small amount directly from the federal government. That would have maybe covered 1/10 of what we've spent on all of this, COVID related safety and extra. We have virtual tutoring and wellness after hours so that students who are struggling with distance learning can get schedule a tutoring appointment with the teacher and get some one-on-one or two-on-one time. Then California was really the one that helped on the interim save the day. And they took a lot of the federal money they received and rerouted it to schools. So, so far, it looks like we'll be spending $10.6 million on things related to COVID. And then there's, at that point, we'll probably start dipping into our reserves unless another stimulus provides some extra money.
So there are a lot of, I guess, opinions and feelings that you need to figure out from different groups. You mentioned the teachers and, of course, the parents, the students, the staff. Everyone comes at this a little bit differently. In general, what are you hearing? What have you been able to gather in terms of the willingness, I guess, of everyone and their opinion of the safety factors of coming back?
Yeah, that one's divided. Not a surprise. Kids are, you know, three quarters of the way like, hey, we are 100% want to come back. We may not be 100%, but we likely want to come back. It switches. Staff is just slightly below 50%. I think it was like 49.6 that say they 100% want to come back or likely would come back. A bigger chunk says they'd like to stay in distance learning for the rest of the year. Right. Don't know if that's possible when a third of your kids, in our case, feel like they're not learning in the same way. We were able to quantify that because we surveyed kiddos. And then the parents, it varies. We still have over 60% of our parents, which has been pretty consistent since about July, that say they're 100% coming back or they would likely come back, but they just can't say they're 100%. So we have kids and parents more aligned, kids obviously younger and feeling invincible that are really okay coming back.
Right.
And staff expressing some, you know, about 50-50 worries.
Superintendent, can you talk a little bit more about sports? You mentioned that athletes have already been coming back. What did you mean there?
Yeah, we worked really hard this summer with Sac County Public Health, and we've been able to do athletic cohorts conditioning since June, when the smoke and the heat wasn't awful.
Right.
And so there's all kinds. We submitted a plan to Sacramento County Public Health. The way public health does it is they say, we have no further recommendations. And so then you're all right. And so there's social distancing. Students use their own equipment. So every kid has a basketball. Every kid has a volleyball. A lot of conditioning drills for football. That is allowed to continue up until sports is supposed to return in December. So in Natomas, what our board did, they invested $1 million in extracurricular activities. And so they're paying the coaches for their out-of-season work. If they're on campus, they get a specific amount tied to their teaching contract. If they're off, they get some money. And then they added in about $600,000, $700,000 in virtual extracurricular activities for students to do at the elementary school. They were packing up science kits and sending that home to kids, or even packing together for a career technical education culinary program. They're packing up boxes, kind of like a HelloFresh or
right.
Blue Apron, and sending that home to kids. So kids are actually still continuing to cook and get the experiences in their own kitchen that they were in our career technical education kitchen.
There could be some actual competition as early as December. Is that what you said?
That's mm-hmm. I think that's when practices are set to return. The competition, I believe, would return in January, but I'm not going to bet
right.
my savings on.
I guess one of the big questions I want to leave you with is if we slide back into purple. And you've already, brought back this round of semi-in-person learning. Everything just shifts back again?
Yeah, well, the small cohorts have been allowed for a couple of weeks now. I think if the state or county determines that the small cohorts should stop, then they would direct us to do that. But the small cohorts were allowed in purple. Mm-hmm. It just, the guidance came out 4 weeks ago and it took some time to put together a plan. And then thankfully with our association, we were able to agree on something in 6 days.
Wow.
What I don't know for sure is once you open, and now that we're in red, if you can open and we go back to purple, what I'm hearing right now is if you're open, you'd remain to be open and you'd follow the state guidelines where if there's X amount of cases in a class, the class would go home. There's X amount of cases in the school might close, mm-hmm. kind of like it was initially planned to be when this all first started.
Right.
However, the guidance has changed four or five or six or seven times since March. So
welcome to 2020, you know, right? Yeah.
2020 should. It's
Chris Evans is the superintendent of the Natomas Unified School District. Thank you for keeping us up to date throughout the pandemic as you have.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it much. Take care.
And I do want to say a hello to Carol at Lake Tahoe, who left a voice message yesterday at the front desk here at Cap Radio. So glad you're enjoying Insight, first off. And thanks for the tip. Carol told me that I should get the Cap Radio app so that I don't miss anything. She was referring to a comment I made yesterday here on the show regarding walking the dogs during the debate as a way to clear my mind. And I actually didn't want to hear any more at that point. But she's totally right. You can take Cap Radio with you anywhere you go simply by downloading the Cap Radio app on your phone. Thank you, Carol, for that reminder and for being a listener up there at Tahoe. Hey, that's Insight for today. I'm Randall White, producer Cynthia Lopez, Kyle McKinnon, and today also R.M. Sarkissian helped us out with the producing, as he always does. We'll catch you back here on Monday.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.